Big busy takeaway for today, May 29th. I'm Tanzina Vega. Mueller speaks.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
Robert Mueller gave his first and only statement as special counsel as he officially closes the investigation. Also, how do you teach kids to be literate in porn?
They have just really frank, open discussions about sexually explicit media and how it shapes their peers' perceptions and expectations when they're engaging in sex or some sort of relationship.
And we're talking burnout. You know what I mean.
Yes, I'm burnt out.
Yes, I have felt burnout.
I really feel burned out at work.
I feel like I'm always on, even outside the office.
I can't ever get the ends to meet.
We start with Mueller's press conference right now.
Beyond these few remarks, it is important that the office's written work speak for itself. We are formally closing the special counsel's office, and as well, I'm resigning. We are not commenting on the guilt or the innocence of any specific defendant. If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. The Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge. We would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime, that there was insufficient evidence to charge a broader conspiracy. And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Former special counsel Robert Mueller broke his silence today to announce the conclusion of his two-year investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, which included looking at links between Russians and the Trump campaign. In a brief press conference, Mueller acknowledged the Justice Department policy that prevents a sitting president from being charged with a crime. He did not, however, clear President Trump of obstruction of justice, and he said today's remarks would be his last. Max Kuttner is back with me in studio to help us break it all down. Max is a journalist covering the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Russia probes. Max, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with your initial reactions to this sort of surprise appearance by Mueller.
It certainly was a surprise this morning. The White House had some advance warning, but no one else really did. Now, observers are really jumping on some of the lines here. They're reading in between the lines. I happen to think that this was classic Bob Mueller. He stuck to the script. He stuck to what is already public. And I happen to think that anyone who thought he was going to come on this morning and criticize President Trump or Attorney General Barr or even Michael Wolff, who we know there's some new revelations coming out in his book next week about the special counsel probe. Anyone who thought Mueller was going to talk about any of those things, I think doesn't really know Mueller.
So let's talk about some of the things that Mueller talked about. One of the biggest takeaways from the report this morning was that Mueller said a sitting president could not be charged with a crime. Let's listen to exactly what he said.
Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
So let's talk about this. Was this Mueller just restating what's in the report, or is he actually doing something by drawing attention to that point?
Well, he is restating what is in the report. There's nothing new there. That said, of course, by choosing that line out of a 400-page report, he does want to highlight it. And there were many other things he highlighted this morning, but that certainly seems to be an important one. I think he's aware that that is getting a lot of public attention. I think, you know, we know that he had clashed a bit with the attorney general regarding that decision to make a prosecutorial judgment. So he certainly wanted to point that one out this morning.
Want to point out a couple more things that Mueller said. I want to drill down on the language that Mueller is using. We know that he's using very specific language. You mentioned he's choosing very specific things to pull out of this more than 400-page report. Let's play another clip from this morning.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime.
Max, this is one of the most confusing parts of this entire investigation and this entire report. What exactly is Mueller saying? Did the president commit a crime or did he not commit a crime?
Right. He's saying that he's not going one way or the other. Of course, this has gotten attention previously, and this is the line that observers and analysts are really jumping on. Basically, the special counsel is saying that he's not saying President Trump didn't commit one, and he's not saying that he did.
But isn't that the prosecutor's job? Isn't that the special counsel's job to determine if he did or didn't?
Well, that's pretty much what Attorney General Barr has said, and that's why Barr ended up making that decision, even though the report does not. And that's what all the controversy has been about. Robert Mueller cited today the Justice Department guidelines, which say it's not the job of the Justice Department to indict a sitting president. You just can't do it. But what is interesting is that Attorney General Barr and then acting, you know, the Deputy Attorney General at the time, Rod Rosenstein, did decide to go against that guideline and make the judgment.
Okay, so what's your insight into how Mueller addressed obstruction of justice? Because again, there's confusing language here. Is Mueller saying that the president obstructed justice or not?
He's not saying he didn't, and he's also not saying he did.
You see, but Max, that's really hard for me and I'm sure a lot of other people to take.
Yeah, absolutely. And for that reason, because there's a little bit of vagueness there, that's why you have observers and analysts just in the past hour kind of taking that as a bit of a wink and a nod. And they're thinking we should be reading in between the lines here. And this is Mueller saying it's Congress's job and perhaps Mueller, you know, indicating to the Democrats that they should take this up. Now, I happen to think that that's not what Mueller intended. He is not, until he has resigned as being a special counsel, he's a federal prosecutor. He's not a dramatic figure. He's very stoic. This is a guy who's known not to wear colored shirts. He only dresses in white shirts. He doesn't keep a lot of friends. I don't think he's trying to be too coy this morning. That said, that's the way that everyone's taking it, and we have responses from Democrats this morning calling for impeachment. We have Jerry Nadler with a big statement out.
Well, I do want to dig into that because I wonder where the Democrats stand now. Before we get into their positioning, I want to hear what Mueller had to say about testifying in front of Congress. Let's take a listen.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
Max, if the Democrats subpoena Mueller after this statement, after he explicitly said he would not testify beyond what he said today, is that going to be seen as a political move, as a hostile move? And is it even in their best interest to do so at this point?
I'm not sure it's in their best interest. I think so. We know that multiple congressional committees have already requested that he testify. I happen to think that they will continue to do so. Certainly the Republicans will accuse the Democrats of being political and continuing after he has made this statement. But I think it's going to be a very boring hearing, and we're going to have Bob Mueller sitting there and saying, "I can't answer that. I can't answer that." And all his answers, as he said today, will be from those 400 pages, which he'll know very well.
And after Mueller finished that statement, President Trump tweeted, and I'm quoting here, "Nothing changes from the Mueller report. There was insufficient evidence, and therefore, in our country, a person is innocent. The case is closed. Thank you. That is the President of the United States." Max, is the case closed?
The case is not closed. Well, first I want to address, Tanzina, the insufficient evidence. Obviously, in the report, that comes in regard to coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Mueller reiterated that today, and it's true. There was insufficient evidence to move forward with that. That said, Mueller has not said there was insufficient evidence with the obstruction of justice charge. Of course, it's not up to Trump to say whether the case is closed or not. Mueller seemed to indicate today that at least the special counsel case is closed, but we know that some of the special counsel cases are in fact moving forward. The investigation isn't, but the Roger Stone case, for instance, is still moving forward. The cases against Russian nationals are still moving forward.
I want to actually drill down on that a little because I think we are losing sight. And Mueller actually ended his statement by saying Americans should be paying attention to the fact that, I'm paraphrasing here, that our election essentially was compromised. Mueller did draw attention to Russia. Let's take a listen to that.
And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Max, what are we losing sight of that the special counsel, or former special counsel now, Robert Mueller, thought that it was that important to end this statement with?
Right. And this is something that I think has been lost in all the conversations now going back 2 months or so, or maybe even 3 months since the report was about to come out. The Russian meddling aspect, the Russian interference aspect. Mueller is pretty clear in the report, the first half of the report, about this, that Russia did in fact meddle and these cases are ongoing. This was through two different ways, one way through hacking, the other way through social media campaign, as he said this morning. So I think it's important for people to remember that. And I also think this is something we haven't heard enough of from the White House and from President Trump. Really, their language has been all about the coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians and how Mueller found insufficient evidence of that, and also the obstruction of justice issue. And also, I should say, from Democrats and from some people on the left, they've also focused on those things. But this Russian interference aspect is really important. I think FBI Director Chris Wray knows this, and that's why just a few weeks ago, he was saying we have to watch out for the 2020 election. People in the national security world are keenly aware that this remains an issue and are trying to bring attention to it.
And of course, the big political question now is whether or not Congress moves toward impeachment. Elizabeth Warren did tweet this afternoon and she said, and I quote, "It's an impeachment referral and it's up to Congress to act." Final words on that, Max. If the Democrats move forward towards impeachment, now what?
Well, yes, and in addition to Warren, at least three other 2020 Democratic candidates have also been saying that.
I mean, and it makes sense for them to say that because that'll rally their base, right? I mean,
absolutely, but I'm not sure. It's so much has changed in the past hour, and I know this is kind of in line with what the president tweeted, but nothing, you know, we knew everything that Bob Mueller said. This was all in the report. As you said, Tanzino, obviously what he's choosing to highlight, that's really important there out of 400 pages. But I think there was impeachment talk before. It's going to be heightened today. We'll see if there's any sort of movement, though. People have been calling for impeachment since President Trump took office.
Max Kuttner is a journalist covering the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Russia probes. Max, thank you as always.
Thank you.
So let's talk about porn. The internet has made it easier than ever to access, especially for young people. Around 80% of teens have seen some kind of porn online, intentionally or not. In the absence of sex ed, many adults worry that porn can teach kids unrealistic and even dangerous expectations about sex and consent. Just 24 states and the District of Columbia require sex education be taught in schools. But there's one program that's trying to change that. For the past 3 years, the Boston Health Commission has offered a course on porn literacy to teenagers participating in its peer leadership program, Start Strong. Here's Jess Adler, one of the creators of the program.
Sex education is not mandated in the majority of the country, and so our young people are turning to the resources that exist, and porn is a resource for them. So we thought we might as well explore some of the messages that are being taught.
Christina Quinn is a reporter from WGBH in Boston, and she's been reporting on the porn literacy course. She joined me to talk about how porn is shaping kids' views on sex and what educators can do to address it.
There's a growing amount of research looking at this. And, you know, some of the concerns are around how it shapes kids' ideas of what is a relationship, what's normal sexual behavior. And, you know, if you look at mainstream porn, a lot of it is, if not violent, really aggressive. And, you know, for some people who know that this is an introduction to really young people, they're concerned that this is influencing kids' perceptions and behaviors as to what is acceptable in a sexual relationship.
Now, what do we know? I mean, I was just talking to someone about how 20, 30, 40 years ago, accessing pornography was not an easy thing for a lot of folks to do. How about today? How many young people are watching porn?
That's a good question in the sense that it's just so accessible. It's really common for a kid once they turn, you know, 12, even 10 years old to get their own smartphone. And even if you're a parent, you know, and you set up these safety guards in the phone, it's still pretty easy to access porn online. And there's free online porn all over the internet. And so it's really not hard for a kid to stumble upon it. So as for numbers, it's unclear, but there is research there that says about 80% of teenagers between 14 and 18 have watched porn, whether or not they intended to. So it's a good chunk of the population.
So you've done reporting on a porn literacy program, and I'd love for you to just explain what that is and who's behind it and who the target audience is for this.
Sure. So the porn literacy program is out of Start Strong, which is a program through the Boston Public Health Commission. The whole idea of Start Strong is it's a peer leadership program where they're basically getting kids to talk about dating violence prevention and just talking about healthy relationships and what that looks like and just having a really good open conversation about that. And so there's one element to this Start Strong initiative here in Boston where they have a program called Porn Literacy. So the program started when Emily Rothman, who is a professor of public health at Boston University School of Public Health, and she went a couple doors down to the Boston Public Health Commission's down there to talk with these kids. And she just wanted to talk to them about healthy relationships. And they really weren't that interested in talking about healthy relationships when you sort of frame it that way. But then she asked them about porn, and then suddenly everyone wanted to talk. And in that first instance, they learned a lot about these teenagers and their viewing habits and what they're finding online and what they're talking about. And so she and Nicole Daly, who at the time was the head of the program, the Start Strong program at the Boston Public Health Commission, and then Jess Alder, who's featured in my story, they built a curriculum as to how to talk to kids about their habits around pornography. And these kids meet every week after school. And when I say kids, these are teenagers. They're in high school. A lot of them start out maybe when they're sophomores, freshmen, sophomores, and then they finish the program when they're seniors. And they meet every week. And it's about 8 to 9 weeks long. And they have just really frank, open discussions about sexually explicit media, specifically about porn and how it shapes their peers' perceptions and expectations when they're in, you know, when they're engaging in sex or some sort of relationship. And so, yeah, they have really, really fascinating conversations.
What about parents or anyone else who might have had any pushback to this? Because I can imagine parents who might be saying, you know, this really isn't the place for my child, whether they're a teenager or not a teenager, to be exposed to this, to learn this. Was there any pushback?
No, they actually found that parents were enthused about it. They were glad that they were having these conversations. And, you know, they're not promoting watching porn. They actually have a pretty neutral stance. They're not pro-porn or anti-porn. They just know that a lot of these kids are watching it, and they say you don't have to watch porn in order to be part of this program, because they really use this program as a vehicle to talk about healthy relationships, healthy dating, but also the messages that are sort of embedded in the media. It was sort of great to have this program sort of step up to the plate with a structured curriculum.
We have seen attempts at sort of taking pornography from the place that you described at the very top of the segment, which is where it's very aggressive and can be very violent in some instances. And we have seen attempts at changing that. And I'm just wondering, is this part of a larger trend that you're noticing?
So the Porn Literacy Program was born out of the Boston Public Health Commission's Start Strong group. And I don't think I've seen any other porn literacy programs pop up in other local, you know, public health agencies. However, since they launched this program, there have been several people who were interested, you know, educators, school administrators, social workers who wanted to know about porn literacy and how they can train their own faculty or their own staff to address this problem, because they see this as a growing thing, as a growing problem. And so they're trying to figure out how to do it in their own schools or in their own communities. So as a result, these three women who started this porn literacy program are now conducting training seminars. And I think so far in just the last 6 months or so, they've had over 200 people attend. And they've had a few training seminars. So it is growing in popularity in the sense that people want to know how to have these conversations.
What are the students saying?
Well, it was really great talking to these students who were in this program. They were so articulate, and it was really just, it was great hearing them have these conversations about messages in media, whether it's advertising. You know, there's a lot of advertising that's sexy, right, or provocative. And then how that sort of connects to, you know, the messages in porn, and how that translates into what it's like when they're making out with their boyfriend or girlfriend. And so one girl in particular named Kara, she was saying, you know, when I first started this course, you know, I thought, like, when I talked about porn with my friends, we were kind of like, you know, giggled, and, you know, it was just like this taboo thing, like, ooh, you know, porn. And then afterwards, she said that it really just sort of peeled back the curtain for her.
Learning about porn instead of taking it for face value and actually learning that that's not realistic, and, like, I don't have to like the fact that, like, what you're matching up and trying to do in porn is not okay because I don't like it, and learning that that's okay definitely stuck with me a lot because it makes me more confident regarding even just conversations around sex.
She really benefited from it.
Christina Quinn is a reporter from WGBH in Boston. Christina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Do you suffer from feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, increased mental distance from your job, or feelings of negativism or cynicism related to your job, reduced professional efficacy? Well, you may be suffering from burnout. That's right, burnout. The World Health Organization recently changed the definition of burnout in its international classification of diseases. It used to be considered a general form of exhaustion. Now it specifically relates to, quote, chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. And while your manager might not pay attention to burnout, it's something Jim Harter is paying close attention to. He's the chief scientist for Gallup's workplace management practice and co-author of the new book, It's the Manager. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina. Great to be with you.
So let's all start with the definition. Burnout, as we know, is this chronic workplace stress. But what exactly is it? I mean, what are the symptoms of it?
Well, I think we have to start with, just as you said, the symptoms that lead to burnout. I kind of think of myself, I think of burnout as a psychologist, as the opposite of what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the author of Flow, would describe as a flow state. So a flow state in the workplace is where you have the appropriate level of challenge and you match your skills and abilities to that challenge, and you also have the right kind of environment to support you, and I'd argue the right manager. Burnout really is where challenge doesn't match skills and abilities, and more specifically due to the kind of environment that you're in as an employee, and whether you have a bad manager or not, whether you're in a job where you can utilize your strengths or not. So burnout is going to be due to a lot of different symptoms, but it's really where the challenge of the job isn't matched with the skills and abilities that you have and the supporting environment so that you can get the work done in a productive way.
One of the things, I'm curious, I sort of, before we started the segment, I said, I think I am burned out, and I wonder if that's partly because of the profession of journalism. Are there certain professions that people are particularly vulnerable to being burned out in?
I think there's vulnerability in any profession from what I've seen. About a fourth of people that we study say they're very often or always burned out at work. From a generational standpoint, it's a bit higher among millennials, 28% versus 21% in older generations. But we've seen higher or lower levels. The variance really exists within, at a very local level within industries. If you have more continuous connections with customers, or even if it's internal customers, you're less likely to be burnt out. But so that purpose component is important as well. But that's where the manager comes into play, where the manager can set the tone and help people see how their work connects to something bigger than just the everyday grind that we're all used to.
But work is supposed to be a grind, right? That's why it's called work. Like, aren't we right, asking for too much when we're saying our managers should care about us and we should have meaning in our jobs? Like, some of us are lucky that we have those things, but are we asking for too much?
I don't think so. And the reason is work should have challenge. Back to the concept of flow. How do we get in a flow state? We're so absorbed in our work that time passes quickly and we go home with more energy than what we had when we started the day. That's very possible. It's possible through challenge, but challenge has to be aligned with our individual strengths. As psychologists, we can measure individual strengths, give people feedback on their strengths, help them know areas they can improve on, build some trust. But the goal is to build a challenging work environment where the grind is a positive grind, right? It's where someone looks forward to the challenge of work and where it isn't drudgery, so to speak. So if we assume that work has to be drudgery, I think we're starting in the wrong place.
Is the way we talk about burnout today different than it was 50 years ago?
I think that's a great point, that it's really influenced by everything that exists around us. Right now, work and life are more blended than ever, so people are probably carrying into their work situation things that are happening outside of work, and they're carrying their work home through their iPhone or other device that they use, right? So our work comes with us now, so I think that part of it we do talk about a bit differently, and we have to know when to shut it off and when to turn it on and what's right for us, and we have to have a manager that appreciates us for who we are. It's what we found, that you've got to have managers who are really gifted at coaching individual people, giving them the right challenges, setting them up for success, and giving them critical feedback when they need it. But when you build a trust environment, you can do that easily. People want critical feedback when you build the right kind of environment. They don't want it when your manager is only an expert on your weaknesses. That's where you get the grind.
I'm speaking with Gallup's Jim Harder about burnout in the workplace. Jim, we asked our listeners to tell us their experiences, and I want to play a call from one of them.
This is Sarah calling from Lansing, Michigan. I've worked in the animal care business my whole career, and I definitely see burnout in many colleagues. I've always worked really hard to have a great work-home balance, and yet I still have to take mental health days just to get away from it now and then. I think it's the nature of the beast in any caring profession.
Jim, is our caller, Sarah, just said she takes a mental health day to deal with it. Is it enough?
Yeah, having days where you can separate from work, I think, is important. And certainly having time allotted where you can regroup and recharge is important. And to knowing, I think the key is to know what's right for each individual. So each person has to diagnose that for themselves and have a manager who understands and supports that.
Wondering, Jim, also what your thoughts are on, we talk about the managers here, and I'm thinking about very high profile folks, including Arianna Huffington and Alexis Ohanian, who've both come out over the past couple of years criticizing the sort of always on workplace and saying that people need more time, they need rest, they need mindfulness. But these are also environments that thrive on the opposite of that. In the case of Alexis Ohanian, the co-founder of Reddit, that's a technology company. Arianna Huffington founded Huffington Post. So these are industries that don't really allow for that. What do we do when big, powerful, famous people tell us to relax and we can't?
Well, I think there's some truth to the fact that in many industries, we've got to have more flexibility. That's the most sought after benefit right now. And we need to find creative ways where the same work can get done in a more flexible environment. This relates to, you know, some of the challenges that have been seen with women in the workplace and why women drop out when they have families. Even though men are taking on some more responsibilities in the past, it's still dominantly put on the women's shoulders. And so we need more women in the workplace, and to do that, we've got to build environments that have greater flexibility where they can still achieve high levels. So it does kind of rest on how you set up the management structure, what you expect of managers. You know, I would make one other point. You mentioned the role of the manager, and we see in our data, this is really surprising to me, that managers actually have more stress than the people that they manage. So managers may actually be more burnout than the people that they manage. And when that's the case, how can you expect them to develop an environment where their employees are stress-free or at least have less levels of stress and burnout? So there's a lot coming at managers nowadays from, you know, more remote working where they have to check in with people more often, more information coming at them. The job of the manager is more complex than ever before, and so that's why we have to have the right manager training and curriculum in place so that they can continuously learn how to individualize. And when they learn how to individualize, It makes everything more successful in the organization, not only performance, but also how people perceive their work and whether it's a fulfilling endeavor or not.
Jim Harder is a chief scientist at Workplace for Gallup and co-author of the new book, It's the Manager. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Joseph Novak from Buffalo, New York. And yes, I'm burnt out because I can't ever get the ends to meet. I don't have health insurance or any benefits like paid vacation time. My car is 13 years old. I have a 6-year-old half the time, a house that always needs something, and a 15-year-old dog. I can't stop. I must go to work. I must fix this. I must.
Thanks so much, Joseph, for your call. Always good to hear from everyone out there. Keep your burnout stories coming to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And thank you so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.